You know, technology can be amazing, but it can also be harmful. And it's not, you know, both of those can be true.
Welcome to Talking About Kids. I am your host, R. Bradley Snyder, researcher, activist, and author of The Five Simple Truths of Raising Kids. Talking About Kids has addressed the potential dangers of screens, of social media, and of our increasingly digitized economy before. But a new documentary, The Cost of Convenience, examines the harm surveillance capitalism is doing to kids in a way that is both subtler and more disturbing. My guest to discuss the film is its director, documentarian David Donnelly. This podcast is sponsored in part by the Arizona Department of Health Services Must Stop Bullying campaign through its Title V Maternal and Child Health Program. For more information, go to muststopbullying.org. And now, the interview.
During the pandemic, I think, is really when I started to notice the excessive use of phones and screen time in general. And I started to dig in and realized that during the course of the pandemic, we used technology at an accelerated pace to the point to where what usually would have taken 7 years took about 1 year. That includes things like Zoom and everything else. And so we just were kind of forced into this pattern of accelerated technology use to maintain communication and jobs and everything else. And prior to that, I had been making documentaries primarily focused on the world of classical music. And, of course, concerts and everything else got shut down. And then so one thing led to another. I started researching and reading books, contacting the authors. And I was like, wow, this is really a lot of information that people don't know, especially me as a parent. My daughter's 8 now. I was really amazed that the stuff that we learned throughout the course of making the documentary wasn't common knowledge.
And I want to point out that, and this is always a balance that I need to do with these kind of interviews, because I don't want to give too much away. I absolutely encourage all the listeners to go to check this out, and we're going to tell you how you can do that. So I don't want to give too much away, but maybe, you know, the experts that you found, these aren't wing nuts. These are not, you know, individuals with, you know, their own blog and grinding an axe. You were talking to, you know, major intellectuals, reporters, attorneys from major universities. Can you tell the listeners a little bit about some of the people that appear in this documentary?
Yeah, we have one of the original investors in Facebook, Roger McNamee, who then devoted divested from Facebook once he realized the harm it was causing and started to become an outspoken advocate against their practices. He was very instrumental in the launch of Facebook to the point to where he's the one who introduced Sheryl Sandberg and Mark Zuckerberg. We have Dr. Sophia Noble, who is a professor at USC. She wrote a book called Algorithms of Oppression, and she focuses on how algorithms can lead to discrimination. Amazing, as you could tell, she's very passionate. Yeah. Also, what's different about a lot of our cast is that they're parents. She's a mother. We have Dr. John Hutton, who is a pediatrician and also an advocate for children's literacy. We have Dr. Susie Allegre, who is an international human rights attorney out of the UK, very prominent. We have Carissa Valise, who is associate professor of artificial intelligence ethics at Oxford. We have Dr. Hilary Cash, who is the co-founder and a therapist at Restart, which is one of America's first technology addiction centers. And I'm probably leaving out a lot more people, but that is the
no,
core.
It was
core
an impressive group. And the documentary also includes part of a different interview. I think it was an interview that was done for a news program with Shoshana Zuboff. I think I'm saying her name correctly.
Yes,
because
that
you
was
introduced
a BBC clip that we used. Yeah,
and you introduced this topic of surveillance capitalism. I know that this is something that she coined, but can you explain for the audience what surveillance capitalism is?
Sure, it's a model of an economy to where data is being used to predict an individual's behavior, and those behavioral futures are then sold.
Yeah.
And if you ever have the feeling that your phone is listening to you, you know, it's not just your phone. And yes, it is. What's happening is that it's collecting hundreds of thousands of data points I think it's something crazy like by the time someone's a teenager, the average companies will have hundreds of thousands of data points on our children, for example. They can take this data and they can put it through artificial intelligence driven algorithms. And then they use these predictive models to try to, you know, they're called nudges, nudging you in a particular direction that you otherwise might not have gone. And right. The reason why, it's so dangerous is because first of all, people don't know that it's happening. And they're making money off of this data. But more importantly, a nudge might seem like, oh, it's just like seeing a billboard, or it's kind of innocent. But the amount of screen time that we have, which is approximately 5 hours a day for the average American, while you're on there and these nudges are occurring, it is impacting major life decisions. So right. Everything from, let's say you're in high school, what kind of career you might be interested in, what kind of people you might want to hang out with, what you might want to do for an activity, what to watch, what to listen to, and then huge decisions like what kind of partner to have, or something as simple as should you go to college at all. And you can see this happening over and over again, and as you get older, these decisions continue. To the point of what neighborhood you might want to live in, what kind of properties you're advertised. And this is happening all the time. You can get into your car. Your car is, in many cases, if it's a smart car especially, it's monitoring your weight. And that's being sold to insurance companies in many cases. And you can imagine that if an insurance company, would be very interested to know if you're gaining weight or losing weight. Your television is monitoring, what you're watching. In some cases, there's even another camera coming out. It's endless. And that's surveillance capitalism. And it's we can see the consequences of it in manifesting the mental health crisis, increased suicide rate in our kids. I think one of the most jarring examples, there was a person in the cast who we interviewed, and she has a job called Director of Belonging, and this was at USC at the time, and the job was created because the students were just sitting on their phones in the cafeteria and on campus areas, and they weren't communicating, so they literally had to hire someone to try to get college kids to communicate with each other.
That's not going to be. Yeah,
it's crazy. It's just crazy.
Well, listeners of the Talking About Kids podcast will know that we talk a little bit about this in many, many different episodes about how those social skills are learned, right? And if you're not modeling or practicing them, they're really like any sort of skill or talent. They need to be practiced. And if you've only been using these kind of mitigated forms of communication, then when you get around real people, you don't have that muscle memory. You don't have that practice there. One of the things you mentioned Sophia Noble, and one of the things that I found so chilling about all the different things that she brought up, but she also talked about how you not only get you know, nudged to things, but you get nudged away from things. And that's right. An example that she gave that blew me away was how we go about even fact checking. Can you recall what her comments about that?
She just, we call it a search engine, and she calls it an advertising engine, because the reality is that, you know, the rankings and what we see is based upon people who are dumping the most amount of money to get to the top of those searches. And so a lot of what we think might be, you know, a fact, you know, is actually some distortion of a fact. It could be complete misinformation. It could also just be, you know, partially true. There's an endless amount of, you know, of variables of that. And the example that she uses of how that got to this point was, you know, and Roger talks about this as well.
Yeah.
When the Google founders set off to start Google, they were very idealistic, and they wanted this kind of open library of information to be free to people across the world. They raised a tremendous amount of capital. Down the road, there was a massive recession that happened, and there was that big, when the dot-com bubble hit, and they got leaned on by their investors to start creating revenue. And their original paper that they had written, their thesis, was that if they were to incorporate advertising into their business model, that it would lose all the integrity of what they were trying to accomplish. And of course, you know what I mean? They right. had no other choice but to start advertising. And so even them, you know, at the origin of the idea, knew that there was something ultimately self-defeating if they were to integrate that. And, you know, and that's not to say that these things aren't also magical and amazing. And so right. one of the other points of the film is that we, you know, the fact that our attention spans are decreasing, it's harder for us to be able to think critically. And we need critical thinking more than ever, because we have to be able to hold two truths and ideas in our minds at the same time to be able to solve this problem. You know, technology can be right. amazing, but it can also be harmful. And it's not, you know, both of those can be true.
Well, and before we, because given how dark some of this is, I want to end on a high note. So we'll end yes. with all the things that we can okay. do to make the experience better, because there's a few other darker things that I want to bring up.
Yeah. Okay.
But no, the realization, and you know, I'm not new to thinking about these issues, and we've had guests on that have talked about some of these issues. But just that idea that when you go to fact check with your Google is not serving you up the, you know, the breadth of information about whatever you just, you know, searched on. They're serving you up something based on your existing patterns and who you are. So you're not getting a fact check. You're getting a confirmation of something that they think you already believe.
If you were to Google something where your location is right now, and I was to Google something with my location, with my history and your history, we might end up getting different results. And yeah. some of those results might be blended, but that's, you know, if you're trying to have a conversation and you have to start with a fact that you can both agree on in order to reach a compromise, that's very hard if people are getting different basis points.
Yeah.
And the example that I wanted to not forget about, if we're going to go dark, is back to this idea of nudging, because there was a sequence that we originally had in the film that we cut out because it just was, I think, too long and you know, didn't want to overdo it. But it's the concept of, if you're a navigator and you're on the ocean and you just change your direction by 1 degree, you could be on an entirely different continent than what you initially had anticipated. Mm. And so that little nudge in your life, if you just get nudged in a slightly little different direction, that could have an endless amount of other consequences that could completely change your life. And that's how we have to look at it. Like, you know, you're a captain of your ship and you're navigating through this thing we call life. And especially at a young age, you know what I mean? When people right. need help along the way. And if you're getting kind of nudged and getting this information and a little nudge here, a little nudge there, it's not like it's barely changing things. Because of the consequences of some of these decisions, it could completely change and permanently alter the course of a human life. And it's an algorithm, not a person, that's doing that.
Oh, and we're going to talk about the algorithms here in just a second. Okay. One of the other things that I thought was so interesting, since you mentioned, you know, the founders of Google, the people who are behind these products, there's a cynicism there. And one of the things that came out, and it was your guest Julie Albright that like pointed this out, she was talking about how the children of the tech elite, how they are educated. Tell us a little bit about how they are educated. I'm assuming it's in virtual reality machines and with all the smart devices. Yeah. And
of course, this isn't everyone, but it is, you know, very common in places like Silicon Valley, in Hollywood as well, by the way, where kids are going to tech-free schools. Yeah. And we're seeing this more and more. They're using... they're doing physical things like movements, where they're getting lots of, you know, FaceTime with each other, direct FaceTime, as well as the arts, and as well as, very traditional education, to where the screens are removed. It's unfortunately becoming a class issue.
Yeah.
To where, imagine if you're, if you're a single mom and you're working multiple jobs and you come home and you're exhausted, of course it's easier to give a kid an iPad or to do something. But I mean, and that's understandable, and we shouldn't blame people for, you know, situations that they're in. But there's got to be a red flag when the people that are creating the technology oftentimes don't let their own kids use what they created. So it's like, what do they know that we don't?
Yeah. That has me thinking a lot, because I remember in the beginning of the 2000s, we were talking about a digital divide. There was a digital divide in our society, and that digital divide, and the people who were talking about it were people like Vice President Al Gore. And that digital divide was between elite families that had technology and access to the internet, and poor communities that didn't have technologies or access to the internet. I was actually a part of a nonprofit that brought computers and internet into less resourced neighborhoods, right? And now we're seeing almost a flip, where there are schools that I've worked with in poor communities that don't have teachers. They just have computers for certain subjects, where they are getting none of that individual interaction, and certainly none of that exposure to nature or outside or physical activity. It's weird. It's like a new digital divide, David. It's crazy.
It's just beginning. And we're seeing it not just in education, but we're seeing it, in other areas of life too. But, phone-free schools is a new thing. That's definitely something to, part of this is because things like getting on the internet and having a phone have become more ubiquitous and affordable to more people. And so the scalability wasn't there when, we were younger and there was, physical encyclopedias and, internet was still relatively new and it was slow and you had to use the phone jack instead. All of that, has completely flipped. And a big part of that, too, is you can see this in restaurants. In New York, there's places. The new cool places to go to are detox restaurants, where, you have to put your phone in, someplace to where, and so it's quiet and there's no, how to take it out. And that's the same thing for holidays. There's quiet zones. And so now it's a sign of luxury to be tech free. And there's a lot of people that can't afford to be tech free if they miss a work call, they might feel like they can get fired, or if they're a gig economy worker and they're missing an opportunity for, a food drop off or a pickup. And so this is just just beginning. And we're seeing this now, not just become connected to mental health, it's also to physical health. We can see a lot of technologies that are available to people, like Prenuvo, that is this body scanning software that has early detection for cancer. But it costs $3,000 every visit. But, it's like, very few people can afford that to do it regularly. But these are all things that we have to acknowledge, and they aren't going to go away because we haven't attacked them at the core yet.
Right.
We haven't dealt with it. We keep dealing with the symptoms. And the symptom is whatever the newest technology is. you know, that was social media. Right. That now that's, you know, AI, and it's just going to continue until we actually start to have a real conversation about our relationship with technology as humans and start to figure out what are some basic guidelines that we want to adhere to no matter what these technologies mm-hmm. are.
Well, and I think that, you know, my comments about that, and I've been pretty public about that. I was actually on an NPR program right after Instagram, after the attorneys generals were starting to bring suits against Instagram. And my point with that is, look, if Instagram was breaking the law, we absolutely need to hold them accountable. But where if we think that punishing Instagram is going to make things go away and or improve mental health, we're wrong. There's other stuff going on here. There's a yeah. bigger issue. And lest my listeners think that we're only going to focus on the negative, one of your guests kind of consistently brought up small things that seemed like they were pretty doable that might make a difference. And I'm thinking of Carissa Valise. She's from Oxford. Is that correct?
Yeah, she's a professor at Oxford. Yes, she's Spanish, but she's a professor at Oxford. Yes.
And what were some of the things that she had kind of a laundry list of little things that we've given up that we could potentially take back?
It's everything from, I don't remember what we kept in the film and what we kept out because, right. We're in the process of putting together some bonus features that focus on the solutions that were brought up in right. the film because obviously, you know, the first part was just to identify and agree upon the problem. But it's about taking control of your data.
Yes.
And to get more of that, really, if you read her book, which is fantastic, it's called Privacy is Power. Mm-hmm. And it's just it's really eye opening. But it's about when you have these little options to choose from. We typically just always accept, you know, whatever is in front of us instead of that doesn't mean we have to read the terms and agreements. It just means to be kind of more aware about, you know, what we do. Using a VPN, I think, is one of the things she talks about. Protecting our data when we're out. I mean, I think the animation that we show to where how you can get your data taken and pretty much anywhere you go, that these things are household-made devices that are easy to build that can extract data from people yeah. walking by. And being aware, mostly, of how your data can be used against you. The TV thing is another example. You know, whatever you're watching, it's not just to give you an algorithm to help you find something else to watch. It's also being sent to hundreds of companies to let them know your viewing habits.
Right.
This is impacting the way that we tell stories. You know, a lot of the streamers now adopt a business model called reverse distribution, which is collecting data because they know exactly how long you watch a particular actor, what storylines you like, etc. And they put together kind of a wish list of things, that variables that they think would do well with a particular demographic. And then they go to the creatives and they say, hey, if you have a cowboy with this and this and this and this, you know what I mean, in this location, then, you know, we'll green light
right.
it. Which kind of is the opposite, which before was, hey, if it's a really great script or authentic script or at least a marketable script, that's, you know, those were. And so now it's changing the way that we create content.
Yeah, I think that to kind of summarize what you just said there and what I heard her say is that, you know, just needing to give consent and needing to know how our data about us is being used, that it shouldn't be a given that all this information about all of our behaviors, about everything that we do is now for sale. And it might have been a voiceover that you gave after a clip of her, but I've written it down here, which is to be surveilled is to be prey.
Right. Yeah, and that's really a great way to look at surveillance capitalism, which yeah. is that you know, there is this concept called a panopticon, which was a prison design where pretty much, you know, you can see you're on the outside and the inside is a circular box to where a guard could be looking at anybody, so you always feel like you're being watched. And that's what we've built for ourselves with these technologies is self-prisons. And that's what we feel like. Subconsciously, I think it causes a lot of lingering anxiety because evolutionary, you know, which is what Carissa talks about, it's like we're prey on a savanna and, you know, we feel like we're being hunted. You know, Susie Allegre, who is also in the film, The Attorney, has a great, great book called Freedom to Think. She goes so far as to accuse these companies of violating their human rights for taking away our autonomy. And I thought that was like, wow, human rights violate? And, you know, and it's not, you know, this is billions of people. Right. And, you know, and she's having a lot of success with packaging these arguments and getting traction. And, you know, there are laws in place to protect people. It's just for some reason, those do not translate to the digital world. As Carissa says in the film, if someone was to come into your house and take your mail, you know, that's a crime. But somehow you can get away with it and if you do things online.
So the documentary, and I mentioned this before, is called The Cost of Convenience. And David, what's your goal? How would you like to see this documentary get used?
Well, we independently financed this. We did not take the advice of some agents who wanted us to make this political one way or the other, or to make it more, you know, kind of, you know, involving more of the tech people themselves. What we wanted to, what we really hope that this does is offer an opportunity to unite us in a time where everybody feels divided and confused, and to remind us that we're part of something bigger than ourselves. And this is the one problem that everybody can get behind. It's, you know, it's non-political. It's, in fact, both sides of the party, both parties have, you know, have taken action against this. It's something that parents care about. It's something that kids themselves care about, you know, wanting a better life for themselves. And so really, I want to inspire, you know, a paradigm shift in our relationship with technology and start setting some basic guidelines. And it starts with just understanding how it's impacting us. And I hope this film is just, you know, the starting point for people to self-educate and to become aware to protect themselves and their families. Because, you know, there's a tremendous amount of resources that this opens up to, from just understanding who these people are, who you can start following, the books, you know, that kind of inspired the film, as well as if you go to our website, there's places to where you can, you know, sign up for certain petitions. It's just there's a lot that's happening right now, and it's hard to make sense of it all. And we hope the film has a big enough approach that encapsulates this larger problem to where we can get to the root of it and stop chasing technology and ultimately start, you know, living in harmony with it.
And if somebody wanted to bring this this film to their communities, to a parent-teacher organization or to, you know, a citizens group, how can they do that, David?
There's a link on the website for screenings, and you click on the link. There's a form to fill out. Someone from our team will get back, usually within 24 hours. It's a very simple process. We have an educational version of the film that's broken up into parts so that teachers can use it in classrooms. We have prompt questions. We have screenings that are coming up, including one in the UK at Cambridge. We can do these privately. We can do these in partnership with universities, with organizations. We really just want to get the word out, and, you know, we'll do whatever we can to work with people's situations and viewing opportunities to get as many people as possible to see it.
And now I feel compelled to ask, as somebody that cares about mental health, how are you doing, David? Because I was watching, as I was watching the documentary, I couldn't help but wonder if there are moments when you started to think, are they watching me? Are they hindering this documentary?
I'll say that we got nudged. We got nudged in real life. There are definitely some individuals and entities that did not want us to, you know, to share this message, that wanted us to take more of a, you know, an optimistic approach. And, you know, I am very optimistic about the future, but I think the optimism lies in all of us realizing that this is the problem and then coming together for the solution. It's not to, you know, to minimize the scope of the problem, which is, I think, existential in so many ways, because all of these other issues that we're facing that seem like they're life or death, whether it's political polarization, civil unrest, whether it's climate change, I think from the film you can see that they are all connected to our relationship with technology in some form or another.
Well, congratulations. So yeah.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
Yeah, no, congratulations on the film. I think it's, I really enjoyed it. I've already been recommending it. And thank you for the bravery that it took to make it.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the work that you're doing, and I appreciate the invitation, and would love to hear what your audience thinks about it. If they get a chance to watch, please send us an email, let us know what you think, and spread the word if you believe it's an important message.
That was David Donnelly. For more information about David or The Cost of Convenience, please visit talkingaboutkids.com. From there, you also can find out about upcoming episodes, suggest a topic, learn more about me and my books, or submit your questions for future guests. Our theme song is by The Senators. For more of their music, go to thesenatorsmusic.com. And remember, kids are young goats and young humans, and the difference is that young goats are easier to manage.